From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, just the beginning, the US and its Arab allies pound Islamic State targets and an Al-Qaeda splinter group in Syria promising a sustained mission against the jihadists.
Last night's strikes are the beginning of a credible and sustainable, persistent campaign to degrade and ultimately destroy ISIL.
Also today, the Center for Disease Control warns the Ebola outbreak in West Africa could see over a million cases by January. And world leaders gather alongside celebrities for the UN Climate Change Summit in New York.
There's one issue that will define the contours of this century more dramatically than any other, and that is the urgent and growing threat of a changing climate.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From feature story news in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. At least 70 Islamic State militants and 50 fighters with another group linked to Al-Qaeda were reportedly killed in the first round of U.S.-led airstrikes on Syria. President Obama says he's proud that U.S. forces went into battle shoulder to shoulder with their counterparts from five Arab nations. And the U.S. says some militants were targeted because they were plotting a terror strike against international aviation. Washington correspondent Simon Marks reports.
U.S. officials say President Obama authorized the airstrikes on Syria last Thursday after a visit to U.S. Central Command in Florida. And it wasn't just Islamic State militants who were targeted, but members of Khorasan, a rump group of Al-Qaeda supporters the U.S. now says was near to the execution stage of a terrorist strike against the U.S. or Europe. The president called them seasoned Al-Qaeda operatives. And he underscored the action against Islamic State militants was backed by Arab partners, including Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Jordan, and Qatar. Simon Marks, Washington.
Osama bin Laden's son-in-law has been sentenced to life in prison by a judge in the United States. Sulaiman Abu Ghaith, a spokesman for Al-Qaeda, had been convicted back in March of conspiring to kill Americans and other terrorism-related offenses. Malcolm Brown has more.
Prosecutors argue that Sulaiman Abu Ghaith became the public face and voice of Al-Qaeda following the attacks of September 11, 2001. He was called a mouthpiece of murder for his role in recruitment and promoting further attacks on the US. In his own testimony, Abu Ghaith recounted being told by Osama bin Laden himself of Al-Qaeda's role in carrying out the 9/11 attacks. The defense, though, had called for a lesser punishment, arguing that their client was merely a propagandist who is being punished for talking. Malcolm Brown, Washington.
World leaders are meeting at the United Nations in New York to discuss a plan to tackle climate change. Those in attendance will each take an opportunity to speak about their country's long-term plan for reducing carbon emissions. Internet giant Google has also weighed in on climate change. The company has cut ties with a right-wing lobby group that opposes U.S. action on global warming. The search giant's chief executive, Eric Schmidt, says the American Legislative Exchange Council is literally lying. Rebecca Bowring reports from San Francisco.
The world's biggest internet search company says it made a mistake in funding the political group known as ALEC, which has previously called for an examination into how carbon capping might hurt the economy. Google reportedly paid the group about $10,000 a year as part of a lobbying campaign on an unrelated issue. But Eric Schmidt says the company should not align itself with people who are making the world a much worse place.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The World Health Organization and the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention have warned that the number of people infected with the Ebola virus could pass 1 million as early as December. More than 2,800 people have so far died of the disease in West Africa. Meanwhile, Sierra Leone has sealed off all borders with Liberia and Guinea in an attempt to combat the disease. Gary Alfonso reports from Lagos.
The move by Sierra Leone to close off all borders with Liberia and Guinea comes about 3 weeks after its neighbors blocked all borders in and out of Sierra Leone. There are mixed opinions from government and health authorities about the success of a three-day total lockdown of all people in Sierra Leone over the weekend. Despite international warnings that Ebola cases could pass 1.4 million by January, rural communities continue to defy healthcare efforts. Reports of Ebola victims being dumped in rivers and streams in rural Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone are being reported daily. Gary Alfonso, Lagos.
German-American journalist Michael Scott Moore, held hostage for 2.5 years in Somalia, has been freed. He had been researching a book on piracy at the time of his abduction and had worked for Germany's Spiegel Online, among other media outlets. Nina Maria Potts reports.
Kidnapped in January 2012 while researching a book on piracy, Michael Scott Moore is now a free man. His family said they'd never lost hope that he would one day be freed. US and German authorities are said to have attempted to negotiate his release, but over 2.5 years, he'd been held in various locations in an autonomous region in central Somalia where pirates are active, called Galmudug State. Reports say he is in good condition and thrilled over his release. Armed groups have been battling for control of Somalia since the collapse of the government there in 1991.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. Sound of a Tomahawk cruise missile being fired by the US Navy at Islamic State targets in Syria. Before joining other world leaders at the climate change summit in New York, President Obama had this to say about his country's air operation against the IS militants.
We are joined in this action by our friends and partners, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Jordan, Bahrain, and Qatar. America is proud to stand shoulder to shoulder with these nations on behalf of our common security. The strength of this coalition makes it clear to the world that this is not America's fight alone.
American-led airstrikes were carried out overnight inside Syria against a number of IS targets and the Khorasan Group, an al-Qaeda splinter movement. General William Mayville, director of operations of the Joint Staff, said US intelligence revealed Khorasan had been plotting imminent attacks against US or European targets.
We know that the Khorasan Group has attempted to recruit Westerners to serve as operatives or to infiltrate back into their homelands. The Khorasan Group is clearly not focused on either the Assad regime or the Syrian people. They are establishing roots in Syria in order to advance attacks against the West and the homeland.
FSN's Lorna Shaddock discussed this latest series of strategic military moves in the region with defense and national security analyst with the American Enterprise Institute, Philip Lowhouse.
The timing is particularly interesting, right? We've just gotten more involved in Iraq, and the president actually seemed in his recent comments to not really want to become, or he seemed a bit hesitant to become even more involved in the region. I think that the strikes against the Khorasan group are really critical here. I think that's very critical to why the timing was, why these airstrikes took place when they did. We haven't heard a lot about the details of this attack that this president has stated was imminent against the United States, but if that was actually the case, then I mean, if he feels that he has a lot of political fallout to deal with these airstrikes, he would have a lot more political fallout to deal with if any kind of attack were to occur on the homeland.
And that is interesting, this Khorasan group, because I think we haven't really heard anything about
That's
them
right.
until the last few days, really. And yet, suddenly, we've gone from the Pentagon and the White House saying there are no attacks planned against the US that we know of to we're taking these militants out because they were planning on attacking Americans. Why that difference all of a sudden?
Sure. Well, it could be several different things. First off, the administration may have had information about the Khorasan group. Maybe they didn't have information about an imminent attack yet, or maybe they did, but they were checking to see if it was actually credible. It's not uncommon at all for this administration or any prior administration either to kind of keep information about those things close to the chest, simply because by revealing the fact that they know, they can sometimes inadvertently reveal sources or methods and means. But you know, the timing is very curious, I will admit. You know, the Khorasan group is not something that people who don't follow this very closely really have kind of really heard about before. In fact, I had heard about them before, but they're really just doing a basic Google search for them. There really weren't a lot of articles out there about the group. When people think about Syria and terrorists, they think about, the Islamic State, or they think maybe about Jabhat al-Nusra or other groups like that. But the al-Qaeda affiliates get a lot less attention. But that said, this is probably something, I mean, one would hope that the administration has been following this offshoot of al-Qaeda and you know, that now is just time. I mean, the timing is also interesting regarding where Assad's army is at and like where what the developments are like in Syria right now. There was a, even if the Khorasan group had not, if they had not identified an imminent attack, there's a, the fact that the Assad group, that the Assad is kind of restricted to the coast right now, there's a window of opportunity to conduct strikes like this that may not have existed for much longer.
So President Obama, in his remarks today, also really played up the nature of this alliance with five Arab countries. How significant is their participation really? I mean, he obviously played up the importance of their involvement, but he sort of has to, doesn't he?
Yeah.
How key are they really? It seems to be mostly the US.
Right. Well, I think the messaging is really the key here. This is an optics move. I think that the United States certainly has the capability to have conducted these strikes on their own. But by getting other nations involved, and especially getting other Sunni nations involved, they send a message that you know, not only is there international support behind these strikes in advance, of course, of the UN General Assembly that's happening, but there's also, and this is critical, there's Sunni support for it, because that way it can be, I mean, the roots of the problem is really an ideological problem rooted in like an extremist strain of Sunnism. So by having Sunni nations involved, it sends the message that, hey, you know, they view this as a problem as well. And, you know, and I think that that's true on the surface. I mean, they also could be targets of this group in the future because they're viewed as too moderate or things like that. So I think that they do have a shared interest. But, you know, the optics on this also were very politically helpful for, I think, politically helpful for the president.
Indeed. And what about the military capability itself? You said that the US probably could have carried this out all alone. What more can you tell us about the hardware being used on the ground itself in terms of the missiles and the planes and,
sure,
and what that might tell us about the kind of campaign this is and is going to be?
Sure. Well, I thought it was interesting to see that the F-22 was used for the first time here. Of course, that's a fifth-generation fighter that the U.S. has been acquiring. It hasn't really seen combat role yet. And we haven't, I mean, all reports seem to indicate that it performed pretty well. But that's the interesting thing about that fighter is that, of course, it has stealth capabilities. So not that, I think in the area of Syria that the strike, where the strikes took place, the coverage of air defense, the Syrian air defense, is not very robust. But the fact that we're bringing a stealth fighter into the fight shows that the air defenses may actually not be as consequential as we originally thought. Also, we were using Tomahawk cruise missiles, which I think was a little bit more of a predictable move.
And what about the timescale of all of this? Because we haven't heard much in terms of a timescale for the strikes in Iraq. We certainly haven't heard any kind of a timescale for strikes in Syria. Mm-hmm. It's possible that this could go on for months or even years. Are we looking at a very, very long-term campaign here?
I think so, especially when the administration is forswearing the use of ground troops. I think that if it is even possible, which I'm skeptical as to whether it is or not, but if it is possible to degrade and dismantle a group like the Islamic State using airstrikes alone, it's going to take a very long time. Because, of course, whenever we use these airstrikes, they adapt. And then even just looking at some of the imagery for these this first round of strikes in Syria, we weren't even dealing decisive blows. This was not a shock and awe campaign, as we've seen in the past. For example, in Raqqa, the capital, the coalition struck a Islamic State finance center, and the only thing that they took out were the communication systems on the roof. Now that obviously, you know, preserves life and helps to avoid collateral damage, but that also leaves the finance center intact, so these operations can continue even if they, you know, have to replace their communication systems. So I think we're seeing a cautiousness even with these airstrikes that we haven't really seen in the past, and that's just going to lead to these this campaign taking even longer to accomplish the goals that have been set out by the president.
Defense and national security analysts with the American Enterprise Institute, Philip Lowhouse, talking to FSN's Lorna Shaddick. This is FSN Reports. More than 125 world leaders are meeting in New York to discuss the urgent problem of climate change. But with the leaders of some of the world's largest countries absent, notably China's president and India's prime minister, there's scepticism about how worthwhile this conference really is. Nick Harper is at the United Nations in New York, and he began by explaining just what this summit is hoping to achieve.
Well, in many ways, this is the Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon's pet project. Climate change is something he feels very strongly about. Usually, we would have the main speeches starting on the Tuesday of the General Assembly week, but Ban Ki-moon has pushed them back to the Wednesday, capitalising on this opportunity of having more than 120 heads of state in New York to get them all together to hear their action plans of what they're going to do to try and tackle this problem of climate change. Opening today's summit, Ban Ki-moon said now was an opportunity for change.
We have never faced such a challenge, nor have we encountered such a great opportunity. A low-carbon climate, resilient future will be a better future. Cleaner, healthier, more stable, not for some, but for all.
But in many ways, we're not going to see any concrete decisions coming out of the next few days. It's really an opportunity to gather as much support and momentum as possible ahead of next year's big summit in Paris. That's when it's hoped that all of the countries will sign on the dotted line, perhaps a legally binding contract to find ways to cut carbon emissions, and perhaps also to have set some sort of deadline for a date on when they will have achieved that.
And who else have we been hearing from, Nick?
Well, this morning we've heard from 125 different heads of state. Each one of them has outlined their action plan, what they will try and do in their own countries to deal with the problem. But there were so many speeches that they had to spread them across three separate debating chambers. We also heard from the US President Barack Obama, and he spoke very strongly about the need for action today.
This time we need an agreement that reflects economic realities in the next decade and beyond. It must be ambitious, because that's what the scale of this challenge demands. It must be inclusive, because every country must play its part.
So tomorrow the big speeches start. What's on that agenda?
We'll be hearing from the US president again. He'll speak second tomorrow, talking about his vision for world events at this time, likely to speak about the problems that are facing the world, things like the Ebola virus, the spread of that, also the spread of ISIS, the Islamic State, and the threat that that is posing to the Middle East. We'll also hear from Liberia's president, who will probably speak very strongly about how his country is trying to combat the Ebola virus, but also looking for support from around the world, all countries trying to deal with that situation. And then on Wednesday afternoon, there'll be a UN Security Council meeting to discuss this threat of IS. President Obama will chair that meeting, the second time that he's chaired a Security Council meeting. He's the only president in US history that has ever done so. And out of that meeting, they're looking to try and get some sort of resolution for all the countries to unanimously agree to an action plan to deal with that spreading threat of the Islamic State.
Nick Harper in New York. Now, the Ebola virus could infect 1.4 million people in two countries in as little as 4 months. A new report by the Centers for Disease Control says Liberia and Sierra Leone could have 21,000 cases by the end of this month if the disease stays on its current path. The World Health Organization estimates the death rate of the current outbreak at 70%. Professor of Microbiology and Immunology Vincent Rancaniello at Columbia University in New York spoke to me earlier.
In some ways, it shouldn't be surprising because this outbreak is continuing unabated.
Why is this outbreak continuing unabated? What's the problem here? What are we getting wrong?
Well, this is a rather impoverished part of Africa. The healthcare systems are very bad. The governments aren't terribly cooperative. And the people who live in these countries don't trust their government and therefore don't go to hospital when they get sick. So there's a whole range of conditions that have made it a perfect place for the virus to spread among the population and kill people.
Let's talk a little bit about what the United States has pledged to do. They're going to send, well, they're intending to build more than a dozen medical centres in Liberia. They're sending thousands of troops to help. Is that going to be enough to arrest the spread?
It may not arrest it, but it's certainly going to make an impact. This is exactly what needs to be done. We need to have brand new facilities just for treating Ebola patients, where that they can be isolated from other individuals and where trained health personnel can work in a way that doesn't spread infection. So I think that if you make additional facilities for this, you're going to have some impact, and that will reduce the numbers in the long run.
Why is this particular epidemic in this particular part of the world so overwhelming? What is it that the healthcare systems there are really struggling with?
Well, part of the problem is that they don't have any experience with Ebola virus infection. This is the first time that it's happened there, so they're not used to diagnosing and treating it. They're not good at isolating cases once they're infected in the hospitals. Many of the healthcare workers are getting infected themselves and dying. They don't have the proper equipment. They can't treat the patients properly to ensure their survival. And then, of course, many people who are getting sick apparently are staying at home. They're transmitting the infection that way. And then once people in a family die, they have customs for preparing the body for burial, which ensures spread of the virus. So all of these things are working together to make this a very big outbreak.
And realistically, what do you hear within your profession in terms of a successful treatment emerging anytime soon in the near future?
Well, some of the therapies are now being tested in people. There are some vaccine strategies and some antiviral approaches that are just going into people for safety testing. So there is some optimism that those could be used in time to make an impact on this outbreak.
And the risk, because it is a conversation that takes place in the United States, the risk of Ebola making its way cross-continent and being a threat to people here?
It's possible that infected individuals could come to the U.S., but we're very good here at detecting infections. We're very good at isolating sick individuals in hospitals, and we know how to treat them. We already have some experience with a few healthcare workers who came back to the United States to be treated. So I have really very few worries that this infection will be a problem in the U.S. or in many other parts of the world as well.
Professor of Microbiology and Immunology at Columbia University in New York, Professor Vincent Van Caniello. And finally tonight, FSN Spotlight. And with that, here's Simon Marks.
Today on FSN Spotlight, we return to the issue of climate change, which has come under the microscope again over the last 72 hours, thanks to enormous demonstrations worldwide over the weekend and today's session at the United Nations in New York. Our spotlight today looks at whether extreme weather is becoming more common. The town of Revere in Massachusetts is the setting for today's report. It was the site of a recent EF2 tornado, the first ever recorded tornado in the Boston suburb. It damaged nearly 200 buildings, and local residents told Christopher Booker of the Financial Times that they wonder whether it's an indicator of things to come.
Of the many unusual things that happened in Revere, Massachusetts on the morning of July 28th, there's one aspect that the town's fire chief finds the most remarkable.
The fact that nobody could actually was killed, it truly amazing. You know, whole roofs ripped off, you can see the damage. City Hall, everybody was in their offices when all those windows blew in. Truly amazing.
While this tiny suburb just north of Boston has seen its share of nasty New England weather, the tornado that touched down on that July morning was something this working-class town had never seen before, raising questions for local residents about just what is happening with the weather, and if such extreme events are something they should become accustomed to.
In my 63 years in Massachusetts, I was born here. Never had tornadoes before.
We've seen everything but, I guess, you know, from the blizzard of 78 to the no-name storm in 91 and a slew of nor'easters and hurricanes in between. But the tornado was unique, to say the least.
Estimated to be an EF2 on the Enhanced Fujita scale, the tornado scale developed to measure wind speed and related damages, this was indeed unique for Revere. With winds clocking in between 111 and 135 miles per hour, an EF2 is not as mighty as the maximum 200 mile an hour plus EF5. But Revere's EF2 did manage to damage nearly 200 buildings and leave 14 of them uninhabitable.
This is weird. You know, Massachusetts was so nice weather-wise all my life. It was just fine.
Right.
And now, tornadoes like they have in the Midwest, yeah. Like they have down south, this is terrible. This is so different.
With official weather records dating to 1950, Suffolk County had never been hit by a tornado, even though neighboring counties had been struck in the past. But National Weather Service meteorologist Glenn Field says that while the tornado was indeed unusual, from a historical perspective, Suffolk County was in fact due for a tornado.
I can tell you that while it was rare in Suffolk County, they were actually due, because the average, we typically get 1 to 3 tornadoes across southern New England in a given year.
While Field's primary task, and that of the Taunton, Massachusetts Weather Service, is to provide southern New England with day-to-day weather forecasts, he says he's regularly asked about climate change and extreme weather.
Well, people often ask, is weather getting more extreme? And I can understand that question, but as you go back through history, you can see that it actually comes in cycles. We had a very bad period in 1953 with the Worcester tornado, and that was an EF4. It was on the ground for 46 miles, killed 94 people. So for me to say what exactly is happening over a long period of time, I can just tell you what I know since the 1950s, for example, in this particular area.
Strangely enough, Field's insight into the history of weather, and more importantly, where the Revere tornado falls within the context of extreme weather in southern New England, provides insight into the difficulty and understanding if such events are becoming more frequent. Interestingly enough, this is where the ever-important distinction between climate and weather may actually need to merge.
Well, we know something, but not nearly enough.
And, MIT professor Carrie Emanuel says there is very little research taking place between the scientific camps exploring climate change and those researching and watching local extreme weather. Despite this lack of overlap, Emanuel says that the current state of climate models are able to create forecasts for some weather events.
The answer depends very much on the kind of storm we're talking about. I would say probably the one that I think we have the best grasp of is the distribution of heavy rain events. It's a story in some ways of the rich get richer, the poor get poorer. Where it's already wet, it tends to get wetter. Where it's already dry, it tends to get drier. I would say the next thing on the list is hurricanes. And there's widespread convergence in the community that globally will go up. That is the incidence of very high category, say Saffir-Simpson 3, 4, and 5, will probably go up. Doesn't mean it goes up everywhere, but on the average it goes up. Tornadoes are the other end of the spectrum of knowledge. I think we know almost nothing about how tornadoes respond to climate change. By the way, I think we can know quite a bit about that. I think we have the tools to understand that. We just haven't focused much attention on that until very recently.
So then where does this leave Revere, Massachusetts? Was the tornado a byproduct of a changing climate, or was it just their turn? With all the speculation about just what is happening with the weather, does what happened in Revere provide any insight into whether extreme events are increasing? In this case, history says it was time, and climate models are not yet capable of a counter-argument. However, what these two camps perhaps tell us is that with over 60 years since New England's last Category 3 hurricane, when the next hurricane arrives, models point to a storm with a bit more punch. And with history as a guide, that punch is long overdue.
That's Christopher Booker of the Financial Times, reporting from the Boston suburb of Revere in Massachusetts. You can read his reporting daily in the Financial Times newspaper and online at ft.com. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
And that's the Tuesday edition of FSN Reports. If you'd like to get in touch, you can email us reports at featurestory.com or follow us on Twitter. We're there at featurestory. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside Rebecca Foster with The Bulletin. For everyone with FSN everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.